what I've told companies that are like, why should, we're a mining company. Why do we have to speak out on abortion or LGBTQ? And it's like, the problem is not saying something is saying something. And then the final thought I give them really is that one of the best ways to deal with some of these things is to have more collective courage, meaning go as a group. Disney fought this battle in Florida. Their mistake was pushing back on the Don't Say Gay bill alone. They should have grabbed 50 companies in Florida and gone as a group, and then it would have been really hard for the government to come down on them. So I think it's about this collective courage idea. It's easier in a group. And so gather your allies, right? Gather your peers and go make the statement together.
Welcome to the Future in Sound podcast. I'm your host, Jen Wilson. This is a podcast where we talk about prioritizing people, planet, and profit. In each episode, we speak with world-leading experts who help us see the future we want and our role in it. This is episode 21, Courage. Andrew Winston is a globally recognized expert on megatrends and how to build companies that thrive by serving the world. He is one of the most widely read writers on sustainable business in the world, with regular columns in the Harvard Business Review, MIT Sloan Management Review, and many others. His latest book, Net Positive: How Courageous Companies Thrive by Giving More Than They Take, which is co-authored by the renowned CEO Paul Polman, is one of the Financial Times' best business books of the year. Andrew's first book, Green to Gold, has reached more than 100,000 people in 7 languages. Inc. magazine included Green to Gold on its all-time list of 30 books that every manager should own. Andrew is also the author of Harvard Business Review's magazine cover story, The Net Positive Manifesto, and the HBR Big Idea cover story, Leading a New Era of Climate Action. His views on strategy have been sought after by many of the world's leading companies, including 3M, DuPont, HP, Marriott, PepsiCo, Unilever. You get the gist. He's advised a lot of great companies out there. He has appeared in major media such as Bloomberg, The Wall Street Journal, Time, Business Week, New York Times, and CNBC. Andrew, I'm delighted to have you on the Future in Sound podcast. Welcome.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
I wanted to start out with your career. So you were a BCG strategy consultant.
Yeah.
And then somehow you wound up being one of the top authors in the world on green business. How did that happen?
Yeah, I don't know. It's I think most people know as you get deeper into your career that there's no straight line, which is always what I try to tell young folks, including my own kids, that not every decision you make is setting you up for life in this career. Like you could make changes quite a few times. But I mean, the short version was I was at BCG, then I was in media companies doing strategy marketing, kind of typical business jobs. And I went to a dot-com, and you may be a little too young to remember the dot-com crash. You were probably like in high school or something, but
you're just flattering me now, Andrew.
Yes,
I remember it.
You remember it. But I found myself unemployed. And, I think we saw this in the pandemic. Whenever there's really big economic shifts, people step back and say, what do I really want to be doing? The whole thing in the last few years of where is everyone? People disappeared from entire professions. They went back to school. That's kind of what happened to me. I realized I didn't want to go back and do strategy marketing stuff in a normal company. And I didn't really have the language for it, but I had been a vegetarian for a few years, kind of just on the idea that it seemed better for resource use. I just kind of had these sustainability thoughts, but I didn't even know the word sustainability. So I started asking around and started reading a couple key books from, the early era of business and sustainability. And it just got me thinking differently. And I went back to grad school to get an environmental management degree. I already had an MBA. And I started working with a professor there, Dan Esty, and decided to write Green to Gold together, which took a few years, took a little longer than I thought. But that's kind of what kicked off my career in this space. I figured I'd come out of grad school and go work in companies. There weren't a lot of, chief sustainability officers or people like that then, but there were some. But then people started asking me to speak and consult, and I discovered I could make a career on my own because I've never really loved big companies, you know, from the inside. I work with them, you know, I love what they can do and the leverage they have, but it never quite fit me. So I've kind of made my own way the last 20 years. I keep thinking I can't continue this business model I have, but it does. I keep writing new things, you know, trying to find new ways to talk about this subject, even though there's only so many ways, I think, to say this is good for business. And here, you know, here I am still 18 years in.
So listeners won't be able to see, but I have a copy of Green to Gold here. And this is
That's the original.
This is the original. So okay. You know this, Andrew. So I got this book probably 2007. And it was a book that we referred to when I was doing my master's in 2009 on environmental change and management. So this added to the delight when you agreed to come on to the Future and Sound.
And I appreciate
I remember reading it and just thinking, yes, this is exactly it. And this is where I want to focus my time. So you really inspired me, Andrew.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, of course. And look, I one of the things that's really interesting, and maybe we can reflect on this together, you know, since, you know, 2003 to 2006, when you were looking at, you know, writing this book, what's changed? Obviously, there have been a lot of conversations around ESG recently, but how do you tell the story of what's changed since you wrote your first sustainability book?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. There's some things that haven't changed that much for good and bad. We're still having a lot of the same discussions. You know, I get asked kind of daily between interviews and talks and things like, doesn't sustainability always cost more? What, you know, isn't there a trade-off with business value? I mean, I'm still having that same business case discussion. I like to think the reason we're still having that discussion is that there's kind of new people at the table now. And that is what's changed, that everybody's having the conversation. So the world's CFOs now realize they have to be able to talk about this, talk to investors. And so they're saying, what's the business case again? And I feel like this might be the last wave of explaining it, you know, kind of in these kind of basic terms. So Green to Gold was really not subtle. I mean, it's titled Green to Gold. Like, you can make money from green and it's not scary. And here's how you create business value. I think the conversation has gotten more nuanced, kind of broader than just, can we save some money? And in the last few years, there's been just so much change in just what it means to be a business, what's expected of companies, you know, more change in the last few years than I think in the 20 that I've been in this. And there's lots of reasons for that. The pandemic was one. The murder of George Floyd kicked off an entire racial discussion. Even the battles now about woke or anti-woke, which I know we'll talk about, it's kept this topic kind of front and center. So in every other downturn, even preceding when I got into this, going back 40 years, sustainability shrunk, people got fired, right? But in this one, in the pandemic, things accelerated. The number of, you know, science-based targets at big companies just kept rising. So something's different now. I think everyone's at the table now. Like, we won like that first battle that I did not think would take 20 years, but everyone's there. All the biggest companies in the world have climate goals, you know, energy goals. They put out a report. It doesn't mean they all believe it. It doesn't mean they're all moving very quickly, but the first step is that everybody's there, right? And now it's about, how do we accelerate? How do we get kind of systems change going? Because it was going to be really hard unless everybody was there. And one caveat, everybody but most of the fossil fuel companies, they mostly pretend to be there, but they're still slowing things down for the most part. But everybody else, it's kind of on board.
For the final, you know, executives, we don't have to speak directly to the fossil fuel industry, but for the final executives, let's finish this, you know, wave now, Andrew. So when you explain the business case, you've done this millions of times over the past, you know, couple decades. Yeah. What are the really compelling, you know, points that you make? Say somebody's listening and they're, you know, wondering, okay, well, I'm trying to pitch to my Stratco that like, this should be taken seriously and isn't just on the fringes. You know, what are some of the approaches you take? You've done this so many times.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always trying to find new ways to talk about it. I have a new little framework. I need to write an article about it, but I've kind of put this in a couple like exec ed classes and things I'm doing, where I think about it kind of in three categories that, you know, why do we act on climate in particular, but inequality, all of it, that there's kind of three basic logic points. There's a need to, have to and want to. And the need to is like the climate's imploding and inequality is dangerous. And, you know, we need a livable planet. I'm still amazed that's not enough. That one doesn't seem to actually convince many people that, like, you know, the climate's imploding, so we need to get going. But then there's have to, which is really compelling, which is, you know, regulation, you know, more and more transparency forced on companies, you know, de facto regulation, because your big customers are saying, what's your climate plan? And if you're not doing one, we may not work with you. Like, that's in effect, you know, forcing it. And then want to is the business case, which is what I've spent, you know, 20 years. Like, it's good for business. You can save money. You can reduce risk. You can be innovative and create new products and services. That's been important, but not as convincing as I kind of thought. I think what, you know, behavioral economics and behavioral psychology have taught us over the last 20 years is that we make decisions with a bunch of cognitive biases, and we tend to look for data that supports what we want to do for other reasons. And I've kind of learned that, I think for many years I was doing the logic, the business case, the kind of mind part. And more and over years, I do the heart and mind, you know, that there's a, it's the right thing to do. And it's okay to say that. We should be okay saying that in business, because deep down, I find that leaders, they need the business case so it's there. But when they make the decision to really get moving on this, it's probably not because they think the business case. It's nice data to have, but there's some combination of regulation our customers are asking and some kind of internal change, like often brought on by talking to their kids. I hear that all the time from executives. So it's very personal sometimes. So I try to marry the heart and mind thing. And I think the case you make to someone depends a little bit on when you're talking to them. You know, a CFO going into their quarterly investor meeting needs the business case. CFO over a drink can talk about their kids, you know, and what they expect of them, what they're being asked by younger employees, those kinds of things. So it's a mix. I think we got to use whatever works to get people to move quickly.
I find the point about, you know, bias really interesting, like how to get, you know, underneath or beyond bias with someone. And what strikes me about your answer is that it's about maybe when they're not quite as guarded.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I've got to have my armor on right now and show you the business case and my results. And I'm in front of my whole board. And it's almost a soft skill of getting through to someone.
And that's why I think the kids thing has been so effective, because when do you have your guard down more than when you're sitting with your teenager or young adult? You know, like the boomer kind of older Gen X executives out there, it's clear there's lots of data. And I've been talking about this for years, that millennials, especially younger millennials, Gen Z, have a different view of all this. They just, it's a generational change, generational norm change. And those are the kids of the current leadership, right? I mean, so, you know, your typical CEO probably has a millennial at maybe still living at home, right? You know, and they're hearing from them, and it matters. And they're hearing from young employees, right? Young millennials and Gen Z don't seem to have much fear. I've seen it in meetings where they just speak up. They just, you know, one CEO said to me, oh, I know millennials care about this. And I was like, how do you know? He's like, well, they tell me. Like, he goes and does a tour at a factory, one of his, you know, and someone just comes up and says, you know, I'm glad we're doing this, or we should do more of that. There's not as much kind of shyness, I guess, in the younger generations.
That's for sure. It's refreshing to hear more from our younger generations and what they're looking for in business. Now, I'm really interested, you know, moving from, you know, green to gold and, you know, some of the trends that you've seen, now to net positive and the book that you co-wrote with Paul Polman. I'm interested in the story there. How did this book come to the fore? You'd already authored two. So why did you write Net Positive?
Actually, I had three. There's a little secret book that was
there's a secret book.
There's a kind of a secret book. It was a short, quick published book called Green Recovery. That I wrote in like 6 weeks in early 2009, because Harvard Press said, hey, we're in a recession. And I wrote an article that said, you know, green is a good way to deal with recession pressures. And they said, write a book. So it was really short. It was about getting lean and just, you know, kind of focusing on this stuff. So that's always my little child that I, you know, bring up every now and then. But it was a fun project. But Net Positive, I mean, I got lucky. Paul approached me, which people don't seem to believe sometimes, but he, you know, he's been asked for years to write, and he's kind of a humble, he's a really decent human being. And he just, never really felt like writing the CEO book. He says in the preface to our book that it always feels like it's self-justifying or you're, you know, making stuff up to look good. But he's asked so often by, you know, this increasing number of executives who go like, okay, we got to do this sustainability thing. He's asked at the halls of power, right, at Davos or in COP meetings, you know, the climate, you know, global climate meetings, how do we do this? And so he decided we should get this down. And then he had read my stuff, my last book, Big Pivot, he gave to his, you know, all his execs. And I did some advisory work for the U.S. arm of Unilever. So I knew him a little, but he approached me like Climate Week in September of 2019 and said, you know, people are asking me to do this. I think it's maybe time. You know, do you want to write a book together? And I actually took a beat because I know how hard it is to write with someone, even though it's a great opportunity. And, you know, decided obviously to do it. And so I think both of us really had this strong feeling that we're just clearly not going fast enough, right? The world is still in pretty deep trouble on, you know, climate and inequality. And these are destabilizing forces. And so we're trying to set the bar higher, right? Ambition levels, we think, need to be much more than just doing less bad, but actually, you know, improving the world through your existence as a business, which shouldn't sound that radical. You know, if you don't really have a purpose, if you're not improving something, why do you exist? What's the point? So I don't think it's actually a really radical thing, but it's difficult, right? In our current system and how companies are measured or incentivized, it's just shareholder profits that they're focused on. And it's hard to measure kind of the whole range of benefits that a company can bring to the world and the value that creates over time. So that's, you know, that was kind of our mission, is how do we accelerate and get people having a higher ambition in a way that's understandable.
So what are some of the key principles and practices that you advocate in the book to ensure that bar is raised?
Well, I mean, just quickly to define it, net positive means, you know, a business that profits by solving the world's problems, not contributing to them, and by improving the well-being of everyone they impact. The core question is, you know, is the world better off because your business is in it? I find people kind of pause at that, right? You know, and it affects them. And I think people, you know, I found myself, I turned 50 during the pandemic and found myself going, is the world better off because I'm in it? You know, you start having these kind of midlife questions. I think it's pretty common. You know, and I think it's a really important question, right? I mean, what's the real impact here? And so to be that kind of company, we think there's a handful of kind of key principles. The main one is really taking ownership, you know, taking responsibility, not in kind of the old school corporate responsibility, but just in the way you teach your kids, like, you know, you break something, you own it, you got to clean up your mess. You got to, you know, just the idea that a company has this impact across their value chain. And basically, in economic terms, companies have been able to externalize the costs, like put carbon in the atmosphere for free. And it's time to really internalize all that and say, this is our mess. We have these impacts, good and bad, and measure them, understand them, work on them with your suppliers and customers, work in partnership. So it's this larger ownership. Beyond that, there's a need to think in stakeholder terms, you know, multiple stakeholders, to think long term is a really critical principle. Create value for shareholders, but because you're doing these other things, because you're pleasing stakeholders, and to, you know, drive deep partnerships. That's kind of the core of the book, is that the problems are too big for any one company, even the biggest in the world. So we need partnerships with peers, with sometimes competitors, with governments. And there's a lot of that happening now, like more than I think I maybe would have expected. And that's kind of our big push. Those are the critical principles. And then there's kind of a need for leadership principles as well, mainly including courage, you know, to kind of push back and, you know, forge new territory and be willing to go against the grain. You know, it's hard to find a lot of courage actually in leadership these days, but I'm hoping people will get emboldened and get moving.
So Andrew, we imagine we have this courageous CFO and they're listening to you and they're hearing about these principles. Okay, love it. It's not just do no harm. It's okay, like, what's the positive impact? And they're thinking, okay, we've got this strategy committee meeting in 3 months. I'm preparing the agenda. Like, what, like, how can I apply some of these cool principles from net positive to really make a meaningful difference in my company strategy? What would you recommend as some steps?
Yeah. I mean, you said CFO. Do you mean in particular that kind of financial
person? Well, I'm thinking everybody says CEO. Yeah. Everybody says CEO, but it's sort of interesting. Right. It could be CEO, like somebody in the C-suite who has sort of like, you know, they're able to sort of shape strategy.
Yeah. You know, we talk about leadership, and obviously Paul was a CEO, but there's leaders at all levels, obviously the whole C-suite team, but even a step or two below that, someone who runs a brand or a factory, like a pretty big job. Those are, you know, middle senior executives who are really in the middle of it. So this is this question of like, what does that mean for people? What can they do is kind of part of what my work has been this year. I've developed a couple different executive education classes, one with BCG, and Paul and I have a net positive little class launching in a couple of weeks, because I think there's kind of an upskilling need. There's companies, again, they're at the table, but it's a pretty small number within that really understand these issues and what is really going on with climate change. Why is it a concern? What does it mean strategically? What are supply chain issues? What are human rights issues? There's just kind of a learning curve, I think. So, I mean, part of the starting point is, I think, to just get more educated about these issues. And then, you know, kind of within the company, we have on our book website, what we call readiness assessment with 24, 25 questions. And it's things like, you know, do you know your footprint? Do you know the impacts of your business and your suppliers? Do you know what your stakeholders expect of you, you know, now and in the future? Just getting the lay of the land, right? So you can prepare for what are our hurdles and who should we partner with to try to solve them. You need, I think, some self-assessment. And you know, Paul and I always say, though, you really start with yourself. You kind of look inward and say, how much do we care about? How much do I care about this? What do I care about? Why am I working? What's my purpose? How does that connect to my job? And I think deep down, people know that if your answer is my purpose is to make money or make as much as I can, it's pretty empty. And that's true for a person and for a company. When a company says our purpose is making more money, I'm like, well, then you could literally do anything, right? You could be selling drugs on the corner. Like there's no purpose to that. So I think most people deep down do want some other meaning, something they're really providing to the world. So I think that's often where it starts. It's like, well, what do I really care about? Right. And then how do I tap into that? How do I help my organization or my family, you know, kind of move down that path?
That makes a lot of sense. In a way, it's understanding the point of departure. So where are our strengths and weaknesses? And then really defining what's the purpose. Yeah. You know, what's the purpose and how does that tie to solving problems of people and planet and avoiding creating problems? And then from there, it's like, you know, classic strategy exercise, couple priorities. How do you have targets? How do you have action? All that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, a lot of the book is our book is more how to than I probably in the past have written. There was a lot of explaining in previous books about the why, much, much less of that in this one. There's a lot more of how do you do this? You know, how do you build the right kinds of goals? How do you build trust with your stakeholders? How do you build these partnerships? I mean, we're in the action phase now, I think, for the foreseeable future. The rest of our lives is going to be working on climate, right? And hopefully working on inequality and democracy and, you know, protecting people's rights. And we're in huge battles, you know, and part of my job is encouraging companies to stay strong, stay courageous, speak out, because they're in the US, they're feeling pressured to not stick their heads out, not get attacked. But there's such as people's rights at stake in a lot of these debates. And I think companies need to prove to their employees, say their LGBTQ employees and their customers, that they have their back, right? That they're supporting their rights. We're in some really big battles right now, I think, for, you know, not just the soul of the country, but really big civil rights battles. And, you know, sometimes people say, like, what would I have done if I was around in Martin Luther King? Or, you know, well, you have some choices now. We're in some of those same battles, you know, for a number of different dimensions: racial equity, gender equity, you know, sexuality equity, all of it. These are big, pretty big battles in the US and even in many other countries. So we're in an interesting time, let's just say.
And speaking of that, you know, you've written in the Harvard Business Review about this very point, that there are multiple debates happening right now that sort of, there's a through line.
Yeah.
You know, when you look at these debates, and I wanted to ask you about how you think about the backlash against ESG. How does that fit into the context that you've just been speaking to?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's real. It is a problem. It is very US. I think people, I mean, I travel a lot now. I got a lot more international exposure in recent years, in part because the book is much more international than my previous work, and Paul's European executive. And so I see a lot more, and I do a lot of virtual stuff in Asia. You know, like I talk to companies in a lot of places. They're aware of what's happening here, but it's not, there isn't like the same backlash, because it is a political battle in the US. And look, it's affected things, right? I talk to companies, clients all the time. They're feeling like they don't want to stick their heads out. They don't want to get slammed. So there is what some have called green hushing. You know, they're quieter. I can't tell yet if it's really slowed down the work. It doesn't seem like it. Like, companies are pretty far along on like decarbonizing and buying renewables. Like, you know, what the governor of Florida thinks isn't really going to easily stop that, because I think enough have bought into the fact that there's many aspects that are just better business. You know, I mean, in a really interesting turn, there's these attorneys general and states trying to stop state pension funds and people investing in ESG. They're saying they're, you know, discriminating against fossil fuels or something. And there's been these really conservative banker organizations fighting back, because they want to create ESG products because their customers are demanding it. Like, it's pretty basic business at this point. So look, there's lots wrong with the ESG world as it's defined in the financial world, like the funds, the data, the screening, it's all screwed up. It's anarchy. But that's how things start, right? We work it out over time. We get better. People call out greenwashing or BS. I mean, this is the ugly kind of sausage making, right? And I think in the end, because of what I said earlier, there's a lot of really deep stuff happening. There's a drive for transparency. There's youth, young people have a different view of all this. So that stuff's moving no matter what. And that's why I think it's kind of a temporary problem in the US. There's no going back on most of this, right? I mean, the reason companies say you're doing more diversity and inclusion is the world's more and more diverse. My kids are Gen Z. The under 25 crowd is plurality white now. It's minority white. If you want to look like your employee and customer base, this is just logical, right? It's just, I don't think there's any going back for most of these companies. So they may be quieter, but it'll pass. You know, I think it will, and we'll continue the work. That's what I hope.
And when you speak to leaders on, you know, how to be courageous on some of these issues, maybe they've been in the headlines, there's been backlash, they've had, you know, they've been trolled, etc. What are some of the principles that you share with them to ensure that they're representing, you know, their values while also doing so in an effective manner?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, so I get asked a lot, and I'm in these conversations where companies are struggling. Like, should we speak out on pro-choice and the Dodd case last year? And actually, a surprising number of companies did, or they sent letters to their female employees saying, we will cover travel costs to states where you can get care. I was amazed how many companies did that. It was public in that they sent it to all their employees. They didn't make a big press conference about it, but they kind of went and did it to support their employees. And I think, you know, what I've told companies that are like, we're a mining company, why do we have to speak out on abortion or LGBTQ? And it's like, the problem is not saying something is saying something, right? The forces of kind of intolerance or bigotry, they want you to stay quiet, right? They want you to feel like you shouldn't speak out, you know, and like Target went through this, right? They made, I think, a huge mistake and gave in to kind of public bullying about Pride Month merchandise. But I've talked to people at Target, like internal people, not happy with that choice, because there's a huge majority that are LGBTQ allies, you know, and gay employees. So what did they say to those employees and to the customers by not standing their ground, right? That was the mistake. So part of what I tell companies is, look, none of this is easy. You're going to take heat, but there is right and wrong on some of these things. There's rights for like the gay community, and that's, we've been through civil rights battles all the time. And just saying, well, there's people who are angry. There's always angry people. There were people angry when, you know, they integrated the schools in the 60s and the little black kids were brought up the stairs by, you know, President Kennedy's National Guard, right? There were angry people, but so what, right? You know, like, that's how things progress. There's always people who are, they don't want to progress. And so they're angry about it. So I think companies got to stick their ground and realize not saying something is often saying something. And then the final thought I give them really is that one of the best ways to deal with some of these things is to have more collective courage, meaning go as a group. You know, Disney fought this battle in Florida And they pushed back, but I think their mistake early on was pushing back on the Don't Say Gay bill alone. They should have grabbed 50 companies in Florida and gone as a group, and then it would have been really hard for the government to come down on them. So I think it's about this collective courage idea. It's easier in a group. And so gather your allies, right? Gather your peers and go make the statement together.
That's really powerful. Thank you for that answer. You know, I think that, you know, looking to the future, of course, you have some pundits that say, oh, the term ESG is going away. It doesn't really mean anything anymore. And yeah, you know, there's a lot of discussion about that. I'm really interested, Andrew, when you look to the future, obviously it's impossible to, you know, predict what's necessarily going to happen next year, let alone in the next, you know, 5 years. But when you look to the future, what are some of the mega trends that you see?
Yeah. Well, just quickly on that, the language thing, I think you're seeing kind of the smarter companies who are more evolved in this stuff. Like if you go to like Walmart's website, there's an ESG link and a sustainability link. And the ESG link is really the investor relations, kind of the financial world discussion. And then they're continuing on their path talking about sustainability. You know, and I saw this quote. I've got a new article coming out soon about this ESG landscape. And I put this quote in from the CEO of Coke, Coca-Cola, James Quincy, said, "If ESG becomes toxic as a phrase, it doesn't matter to me. I'm just going to stop saying ESG. My business strategy is constant and clear and centered around the business and things that consumers care about and that fix societal problems." And, he says, you know, if you want to put a label on it, that's your problem. I think that's kind of where we're going to end up. Like companies are going to still do the stuff they think is good for business. So I think that partly answers, I don't know, where are we going to be in 5 years? Well, look, there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty. It kind of depends, at least in the US, what happens next year with our election. I think our democracy is at real risk. We might end up in a very dangerous place. And that makes it pretty hard to work on climate or inequality, right? When there's people in charge maybe who are completely hostile to that. You know, the things I can say for sure that I know are happening is, as I mentioned, kind of young people. There's generational norms that have already shifted, are shifting. Younger people understand climate. They understand gay rights. They don't understand what we're worried about, you know, and that's permanent. That's kind of norms about what should business be, what should we be solving, and real concern about climate in particular. So I can tell you in 5-10 years, it'll be even more of a concern because, you know, millennials and Gen Z are moving past the halfway mark of the workforce to like become the whole workforce over the next decade. So the norms around this stuff are changing pretty permanently. The other thing I think I can be pretty confident about is the clean economy is just coming on so fast. And there'll be stumbles, not enough charging infrastructure for EVs or slowdowns in getting enough lithium or cobalt. You know, there'll be issues, but we really hit the point where the tipping point in so many dozens and dozens of countries in the world where the market share of renewables or EVs is now big enough that it just has its own momentum. So I'm pretty confident in saying that's going to continue, even with fossil fuel companies trying to slow it down, because it's just economics, you know, and the utilities are buying more and more renewables, companies are buying more and more. So, you know, that I can confidently predict. And unfortunately, I can also, I guess, predict that the climate's going to get worse. It's a funny, not so funny line people use about this summer. This has been the hottest year ever, but this was the coolest summer you'll ever see in your lifetime. And we got to get our heads around that the size of fires, floods, whatever, is now not a one-off. This is now the weather and the climate, and it's only going to get worse until we start really reducing carbon. So we have to imagine that there's going to be a lot of impacts and a lot of need on resilience, adaptation, people on the move, refugees. That stuff is going to get worse. So it's a mixed bag. I just gave you, I think, two positives and a negative, but we're always kind of on the edge, it seems, like these competing forces racing to see what wins, which outcome, which scenario do we end up in.
Now, Andrew, I have so many more questions I'd love to ask you, but we're starting to run out of time. And so my final question.
Oh, I can do rapid fire. Yeah. I can do shorter, quick answers if you want.
Well, this one is one of my favorite questions. Now, you're an author writing books for us all to read. I'm really interested in the books that inspire you in this space. If there are particular books that you've read that have really changed the way you think.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. I mean, like I got, as I said, I got into this in this kind of few week period while I was thinking about what do I do next, where I just read a few books and they kind of changed my perspective. And the first one I read was Ray Anderson, the former CEO of Interface Carpet. Mid-Course Correction was a book he wrote, I think late 90s. And in it, he talks about his transition and how he read The Ecology of Commerce by Paul Hawken. Paul Hawken's known more now by his drawdown work and kind of putting out all this information about how do we really reduce carbon. But he wrote a book 30 years ago, Ecology of Commerce, that's just still brilliant. You know, really basically said business is affecting the environment in this incredibly deep way because capitalism and commerce use resources. You know, it's a really well-written, beautiful book. I read this book, Ishmael, at the time as well. That's kind of this fable. It's odd. It's about a great ape that develops the ability to talk and gets very smart and basically takes on a human as a student and basically takes him through kind of the model of humanity and how we got to this place and how we use too much. And it's just a really beautiful story that is, I went back and read again in the last couple of years and really loved it. And there's more recent stuff. You know, there's lots of my favorite authors, you know, like Hunter Levin's Natural Capitalism, Cradle to Cradle 20 years ago, but there's more recent books from all those folks as well. There's also, you know, sci-fi in this field. Ministry of the Future has been a popular book the last couple of years that really paints a picture of what climate could look like in a kind of scary way. Because I think the arts really help, like the movie Don't Look Up. I think it kind of reached a lot of people, you know? It was silly in a way, but it felt kind of accurate, you know? Like the asteroid of climate is coming and we're kind of going along. So, I mean, there's lots of things that you know, inspire me, but in the field, those are kind of the big ones that have, you know, driven me.
Andrew Winston, thank you so much for joining the Future in Sound.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Thank you to Andrew for joining us. You can learn more about his work by checking out the links in the episode description or by visiting re.co.com/thefutureinsound. The Future in Sound podcast is written and hosted by Jen Wilson and produced by Chris Attaway. This podcast is brought to you by Rico, a software as a services company helping clients achieve resilient competitive advantage in the long term. If you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to tell a friend about it. And if you have a moment to rate us in your podcast app, we'd really appreciate it. Until next time, thanks for listening.